Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to We Are Drunk and We Know Things.
Do you mean we're drunk and we know things?
Contractions are bad sign of a lazy mind. Yeah, all right, we're drunk. Ampersand, we know things. .com, limited, trademark, patent pending. Anyway, we're in JB Smokehouse. Shut up. We're in JB Smokehouse in St. Helier, Jersey. It's Battle of Britain Air Display Day.
Which means everyone is outside in the sun, absolutely paralytic.
Which means town is busy.
So we've hidden here.
We've hidden in one of the less appreciated night spots. It's the letter U. Which meant that we had some really good movies on the poll.
We did.
And you picked one.
Hey-o!
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of that.
Not too much, I hope.
No. This month on We're Drunk and We Know Things, the movie is The Untouchables.
And then you play Can't Touch This by MC Hammer.
That's what I do. I drink. And I know things.
Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, 1987.
Which is older than you think?
Yes.
In a way?
It's one of those movies that's like a big budget period piece, so that it feels a bit timeless. It feels a little bit timeless, do you know what I mean? Because it's set in the 30s or the 20s even, you can't really tell a time scale. It doesn't date because it's a glossy version of a period piece, so it doesn't feel as dated. Except that Sean Connery looks the same, but Kevin Costner is very slightly younger.
And so is Andy Garcia.
Yes, he is.
There's some baby faces in this movie.
There are some babies. And the babiest face of all is Andy Garcia. As I say, made in 87. $25 million budget.
That's not bad in 87 money.
Made $106 million. Baby.
That's even better.
We'll go into the budget a bit later. But first...
Can't wait.
I'd like to run you through...
That's what people tune in for, you know.
The plot, yes. Budget discussions.
We're going to run through the accounts of this
particular
film.
You have no idea how much, like, cinematography Brian De Palma... wanky film stuff I've had to cut out of this about lenses for fear of being like faded out to lift music again. So let's go through the plot.
I mean, firstly, if you haven't watched this movie or are not aware of
we're doing this every
the
time.
Battle of Elliot Ness and Al Capone,
then probably read a book about it. Don't watch this film because it is not correct.
It's very, very inaccurate,
but it's extremely entertaining.
Right,
we've
so
been doing this too long.
Elliot Ness arrives in, I want to say, Chicago.
Well, let's start at the beginning, shall we?
Yeah, well, it's the best place to start.
Al Capone is being interviewed in his little barber room.
Oh, we're not going to do a shot by shot.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Oh, Christ.
So we open with a crane shot.
No.
So we start in the barber room. He's giving an interview to press while he's being shaved or not. He just gets nicked straight away. He moves his head, though. It's totally on Al Capone. But it's all about like how Al Capone is this charismatic, beloved character in Chicago. It's setting a precedent that
people love
him. But
fundamentally, incredibly feared.
Yes, absolutely. But people still love him.
Yeah,
it's
this
like
is
going to
take you
a
while. So, Al Capone gives the interview. They're like, why aren't you the mayor, Al Capone? He's like, well, I kind of am. Ha, ha, ha. Meanwhile, young upcomer from the Treasury Department, Elliot Ness, has
super
been sent
weird.
Into
presumably because the DEA didn't exist then.
They were replaced by ATF.
Oh, yeah, sorry, ATF.
But
yeah,
prior to that,
it
was, yeah.
So
Treasury.
He,
like the Secret Service dealing with money laundering. It's like, what?
You look after
the president.
Counterfeiting.
And dodgy dollars.
Yeah, yeah. So he has a raid. It's a bust because there's a cop seemingly all the cops are...
All the cops are dirty.
What
have you?
So dejected, he walks home and goes across a bridge where he meets a beat cop, Jimmy Malone, played by Sean Connery, doing a spot-on Irish accent.
I think we're just going to have to draw a veil on the accent. It's too easy. It's
fair enough. He has an awesome opening scene. Here endeth the lesson about he guesses he has a cop and he guesses he has a gun. He says, how do you know I'm actually a treasury officer? And he's like, why the fuck would someone pretend to be a treasury officer?
Why would you claim to be that? Who is not?
Indeed.
That was my Irish accent. That was bang on.
It was.
Sorry, believe it.
I'm really trying to not just do a Connery impression the whole time. It will appear, but anyway. He convinces him. He's like, you should be with me because you're a good cop. And he's like, no, I'm too old. And he's like, yeah, you should. So then he is. Then he meets an accountant, treasury accountant.
Assigned
an accountant from Washington.
By the FBI.
Wallace, who is a ledge.
Yeah, right.
He's really good. And then Connery recruits the fourth member of their team, Stone, who is straight out of the academy, because he said, if you don't want a rotten apple, get one straight off the tree.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So good. And he like be really racist to him and calls him a bad word. There's a lot of...
You can say what?
I don't know if I want
it's
to.
It's in the movie.
Yeah, well, that doesn't mean it's okay. And then he's like, oh, I'm going to put a gun in your chin and I'm going to shoot your head off, you Irish donkey or something. Anyway, so he's in, so that's nice. And then they have a meeting and Sean Connery's like, oh, I know where the booze is. They literally cross the road to the post office and it's all there. And he takes them down. And they're like, everybody knows where the booze is, but no one's got the balls.
The general undertone at this point is that by declaring war on the... what do you call them? They had a name.
The Untouchables?
No, the people making booze.
Bootleggers.
Yeah, all right, the bootleggers.
Yeah.
That you would be declaring war and it would end very badly.
We'd be declaring war on Chicago, essentially.
Yeah,
we've skipped over a ridiculously important scene, which is in the church where they're talking. And he says, I'll join the team, but on these conditions... If he pulls a knife, you pull a gun. If he puts one of yours in the hospital, you put one of his in the morgue. That's
the Chicago way.
So fucking good.
Again, spot on Irish accent.
So fucking good. Then they go out for dinner and they take a photo, which will come into play at the end of the film. Then Al Capone is seen beating someone's brains in with a baseball bat because he was the guy in the post office who sold them out. Well, didn't sell them out, but just was out on his own, running his own kind of
exit.
When I was thinking about the plot of this film, I just wrote up notes about the Untouchables storyline and almost totally forgot about the fact that Al Capone is actually in this film throughout. Because Robert De Niro is so secondary to this film. It's not about him at all. Which is why I guess he plays it so big to make a big impact in these scenes. They tried to bribe him and he's like, fuck you, man, we don't take bribes. Which is why I didn't write this film. Then there's a brief reprieve from the city when they go to Canada or the border of Canada, and it turns into a John Ford film. They're all cowboys.
Horses and Mounties. And
did
I
you
also
know?
Quite like the fact that I'm pretty sure, I don't know by the way, but I'm pretty sure that riding a horse is hard, and if you haven't done it before,
yeah, I know, I was gonna say
riding
this.
A horse whilst firing a gun is nearly impossible.
So Andy Garcia, who is a man pretending to be an American who is actually Italian, who grew up on the south side of Chicago, apparently knows how to ride a horse well enough he can do it and fire a Tommy gun.
Hang on, so does Wallace the accountant.
But he's really enjoying himself. He's like, yeah,
he
I'm
comes
out of the
out
office.
Of himself.
He does.
The raid is brilliant because they get the booze, they get the ledger, which has all the what have yous, and they get prisoners.
Jimmy Malone shoots the corpse through the head to convince the guy to talk. It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
I do not appreciate your methods. It's because you're not from Chicago, which is great because neither is he. And then, sad times. We've got an incredible Steadicam shot out of a lift with Wallace fully embraced his role as a field agent. Goddamn Nitty shoots him in the lift. Hangs him up. Hangs him up.
He shoots him in the head, Mike. Not on the lift.
Touché. Jesus. Shoots him in the head in the lift.
Shoots him through the eye, which is like, ew.
Is it through the eye?
Yeah.
That's nasty. What a bastard. I've never seen the film. And then...
Just imagine, doing it from the Cliff Notes version.
This is the trick of this podcast. I've never seen any of these films. I've just been really lucky with my guesses. I'm batting 300.
So the Untouchables were four, then are three.
Yes, now they're three. Oh. And then they're like, Malone decides he's had enough because the witness is kaput. The DA decides he's not going to try the case. So Malone goes and beats up a big fat policeman who's on the take. So it's like two old men beating each other up in an alley. And he gets the
Old Irish men, but one
Irishman.
Of them is actually Irish. Yeah.
But the Irishman is doing such a ridiculous Irish lilt. He's putting it on so heavy.
Oh, what do you mean?
It is a policeman. It's so
like,
bad.
What are you going to do down Malone? You're
so
going to get yourself
bad.
Killed.
It's
get
so
out
bad.
Of town. Get out of town now.
So he gets the name of the train the bookie's on, but then...
It's not the accountant.
The accountant, sorry. The bookkeeper is what it means. Right? The bookkeeper, not the bookie.
The trouble is that obviously dirty Irish cop with a half-decent Irish accent tattles and Malone gets a visit.
Yes. First by a bloke with a knife, but he's actually just luring him outside and he gets gunned down. In the prime of his... Nope, he's like in his late 60s. He's dead. He's dead, man.
Well, actually, surprisingly not.
He's dead in a bit.
For a very long time,
yeah.
Considering he gets shot, by my best count, about a dozen times.
Eight
front
times.
And
but, yeah.
back.
Yes. Front and back.
I mean, was the Tommy gun loaded with marshmallows?
Maybe. Well, maybe.
Or
rock salt.
Peanuts.
So Ness finds him. He thinks he's reaching for his key and his St. Jude's charm. He's actually reading for the train timetable. And he's like, what are you prepared to do? And then he dies. It's a great death scene. It's a great death scene. I think he deserves the Oscar he got. But the less said about his accent, the better. So he gets killed, and that leads him to Union Station, where the bookkeeper is going to be leaving by train. So it is a big old riff on Battleship Potemkin, which we'll come back to later. There's a pram falling down the stairs with a baby in it. There's like a shootout in slow motion around the baby. It's amazing. Shut up.
What? No, that scene is amazing.
George Stone slides in and tosses him a handgun, and but he catches the crib with his knee, and then he's got the gun up against him, and the guy's got the bookkeeper, and he's like, you got him? Yeah, I got him. Take
and
him.
Gets him.
And then he gets him. He gets him real good in the face. So that's good. But it's not over. You think it's over, but it's not. Because then they go to court. And Al Capone's bought the jury off, it turns out.
At which point it turns into basically a law thing.
A law thing.
Briefly.
Until Elliot Ness pushes Nitty off the roof. The roof? What do we say? Like the roof?
Yeah.
Pushes him off the roof. They swap the juries so that they've got a jury that hasn't been bought out.
Yeah, because he realizes after they inspect Nitty's jacket, there's they a find juror's,
the,
list
yeah, the jurors list.
There's like numbers, and there's like one guy who's $50 and one guy who's $500.
Yeah.
So if you're ever in a jury that's being bought out, go high, go big.
Yeah, go big. Yeah. Ask for whatever you like.
It's Al fucking pay.
And he says, how did you convince a judge? And he says, his name was in the ledger. But his name wasn't in the ledger. But the judge did do something dirty, and he
told him
bad.
His name was in the ledger.
And then he gets an electric guitar out, and he's like, so they swap the juries. Al Capone then pleads guilty, or his lawyer does. Al Capone beats up his lawyer a bit, and then he's like, don't ever stop fighting, not to the end of the fight, here ends the lesson. It's a bit tenuous because Capone makes a thing about fighting earlier.
It's like prize fighters, isn't it? It's like the there's only one left standing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they don't actually remember that was the line he said, so they kind of mangle it a bit.
Yeah, they don't directly reference his anyway. And then it's all wonderful, and Ness gives Stone the cool box key and St. Jude medallion of Malone because he'd want a cop to have it.
Yeah.
Oh, and then he says, the reporter that's been bugging him the whole film says, what are you going to do after
prohibition's
finished? I think I'll take a drink. Which is a really good last line, but is quite bad taste once we talk about Elliot Ness's real life. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. So as I say, made in 87. It was made after De Palma had a couple of flops.
What else did De Palma do?
Carrie?
Well, no, you say that like I should know, but you're forgetting that you're the film expert.
Well, he
and
did
I'm the
Carrie.
Guy who
I mean,
just watches films.
We will come to this a little bit later in recommendations, but he did Carrie, he did Body Double, which is like an homage to Hitchcock movies. He did Raising Cain with John Lithgow. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's a great movie. He did the first Mission Impossible film, arguably the best one.
As Super in the first Tom
with Tom Cruise.
Oh.
Super weird they got him to do it, but I think it's a brilliant movie. But he also made a movie called Wise Guys, which was like a dark mafia comedy with Joe Pesci.
Is that before or after Good Boys?
Before Untouchables.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he made Body Double and then Wise Guys, and they both flopped massively. So he essentially needed to make a big commercial success so that he could make the movies he wants. So like, you know, directors, they do a movie for the studio, and then once they make a bit low money, then they take a chance and let them do something for them. You know. So he wanted to do that. So it cost them 25 mil, and they made 106. It got nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Costume and Best Supporting Actor, which Connery won, his only Oscar.
And what else did it win?
The lottery.
Best Soundtrack?
No, it didn't. It was nominated for 4, only won 1.
No, it was nominated for more than 4, I'm sure it was.
No.
Okay, fine.
Maybe. We'll cut it in later.
Who's the soundtrack by, Mike? Who's the soundtrack by?
Maybe one of those 4 is sound. I think it might have gone nominated for best sound.
It was nominated for
Ennio Morricone.
It was nominated for best soundtrack and best original score.
Oh, so maybe
and
it's
it won
those
one of them. And it's Ennio Morricone.
I don't think Ennio Morricone's ever won an Oscar.
What? I'm just
it
saying.
Was written by David Mamet.
Yes.
Who wrote the play of Glenn. He was a playwright and a film writer. He wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, the play and the film. And he also wrote Hannibal. He's written loads of stuff, but I just thought he'd say he wrote Hannibal. You know, the second Hannibal Lecter film.
I thought that was based on a book.
Yeah, but he wrote the screenplay.
Oh, right. So, sorry, he adapted Hannibal.
It's so weird.
See, fucking film nerds, man. If it's based on a book, it's adapted.
Yeah, well, he wrote the screenplay. He wrote it. Originally, the cinematographer, Stephen H. Burham, whatevs, he wanted to shoot it in black and white. And he initially took a load of like photos of the cast in black and white. And Brian De Palma, when he said, we've got to go to the studio to say we want to do this in black and white, Brian De Palma reportedly said, don't let them break your heart, Steve. He was just like, they're not going. What are you insane? No way. There's just no way.
I'm surprised they didn't have like the classic 20s homage start in black and white and
yeah,
then cut
sure.
to colour.
Yeah, the classic.
Because let's face it, De Palma is a stylistic son of a bitch.
I feel like there's a fair. I feel like they. I remember it, but it's not actually in the film. It's definitely not because I've watched it like 5 times this week. But I feel like it's one of those movies like fade to sepia. He's like looking at the photo of the four of them. And
well,
it
no,
would fade
the photo
you know,
is in black and
it
white.
It is in black and
so,
white, yeah, sure. Okay. Well, that would be redundant then, yes, indeed. Al Wolf, the only real untouchable who was still alive at the time, acted as consultant, presumably just took some money and was like, do whatever the fucking hell you like. Because, I mean, other than Ness, none of them are real. Well, and Capone, obviously.
And Nitty.
And Nitty. None of the untouchables are real, I should say. Which brings us to casting.
Okay.
The biggest piece of casting, the most important part of casting in this, is one Mr. Clifton James. And you're like, why do I know that name, Mike? Why do I know that name? Say it. Anyway, he plays the DA at the end of the film in the court sequence. His most famous character is one Mr. J.W. Pepper.
God
from Live and, from Live and Let Die. I was watching it last night.
And Octopussy?
Live and Die and Man with the Golden Gum.
I don't know.
And yeah,
I knew
so
he was in another one.
I was watching it last night and I was like, I recognise this motherfucker. Famously fucked his mum. I recognise this motherfucker. And yeah, it's because, yeah, goddamn boy.
I do owe you an apology.
Oh.
It was only the 4 Academy Awards. It won the Grammy
for
Best Song.
Okay. Well, let's say we were both wrong.
We
you were
just
more.
Be both right.
Oh, let's do that.
That's much better.
Wow, that speaks volumes about my psychiatry, doesn't it? Let's just assume we're both losers. Oh, no, we're both winners. Okay. They wanted Mickey Rourke to play Elliot Ness. He turned it down. Then they asked one Mr. Mel Gibson. One Mr. Melanie Gibson. People don't realise that's what his name's short for.
That would have been amazing.
Don't know.
I mean, you've Kevin got a Costner Scotsman playing an Irishman. You've got an Australian playing an American.
Do you know who they asked after
you've
that?
You've got an Italian playing an American Italian.
No, they've got a Cuban playing an Italian.
Is he Cuban?
He's Cuban. He's
oh,
a
right,
Cuban.
Okay, fantastic.
He's a Cuban playing an Italian pretending to be an American. and then they asked one Mr. Don Johnson.
God.
So they were all like, nah. So Steven Spielberg actually recommended Kevin Costner. He'd done a fair few films, but he wasn't a big name at all. This was definitely his big break. And they offered him $800,000. So being a ballsy little bastard, apparently he said, I want a million. So in this interview I read with him, he was just like, I wanted a million. It's a nice round number. I was an up-and-coming actor. It was a big film. It's a million. It's got a nicer nicer sound. So he asked for a million and they gave it to him. So it's the first time he got paid $1 million for a film.
There you go.
It's
another
really
life lesson. Along with jury duty, if you've ever been cast in a movie, go big.
Just go big.
It's Al Capone.
Well, they come back and say, no, 900,000. Cool. Fine.
All right.
Yeah, so yeah, so no. I mean,
grand more
and
than,
I think he earns it. I think he does a really good job in this film.
Yes.
I find him a bit bland sometimes, but I think he's really good in this. He's very good
as to be.
That character. I mean, he's not a character actor. Certain.
And the other thing is, because he's so, so young, and it's so early in his career, it's before he got, like, it's before The Postman. It's before Waterworld.
Yeah, well, that's, those movies were made off the back of his, off of his star talent, weren't they? And like, I think he's young enough.
A little thing called The Bodyguard kind of helped him.
Well, yeah, certainly. Yeah, but he's like, he's enough of a babe in the woods in real life that it comes across in the film that Ness seems a little bit out of his depth and needs Malone to help him along. There's that incredible scene in the cabin in the Canadian border where Malone goes around them all individually. And it's like, don't wait for it to happen. Don't even want it to happen. Then he says to Stone, did you check that gun already? Yeah, then don't worry about it. And then he tells Wallace, stamp your feet if you're cold. And he's sitting there eating a salami with a massive Bowie knife. I thought he was eating an apple. I was watching it last night and I was like, no, he is eating a fucking great big salami with a Bowie knife. Because why fucking not?
It's the Irish way.
It's the Irish way.
Eat sausage before you go into battle.
And very much like he's a mentor to Ness in the film, Connery was very much a mentor to Cosner in the making of the film as well. Like, really showed him,
like,
really took him under his wing and gave him a lot of help. Like, Cosner really struggled in the two scenes he has. Two scenes he has with Robert De Niro, because Robert De Niro's like method, going really big. He can like use street talk. He can swear. He goes really big, Ness is such a straight arrow that he's got these very defined lines. He can't like make his performance any bigger. It kept throwing him off. So Connery was like coaching him on acting like throughout it, which I think is, it's a lovely story. It's probably not true because Sean Connery's famously a douchebag, but I like to think it's true.
Maybe he was just having a good time.
Maybe. If Cosner was getting $1 million, what the fuck was Connery getting?
Two.
Yeah. Still a lot.
Budget wasn't that high.
It's true. Oh, we're still going to come back to the budget.
Yay.
That's the only reason the listeners are still tuned in. It's going to be such an anticlimax. It's like half a... Anyway. So the part was written for Sean Connery. Written with him in mind.
Right.
Because they were like, we need a bloke with an accent. Regardless of what type of accent it is, we want a bloke with an accent.
Right, okay.
Americans can't tell the difference between Irish and Scottish. It's the same reason as all those Errol Flynn movies that are set in England are shot in Mexico. Because Americans at the time didn't know what Mexico looked like, and they didn't know what England looked like, so they were just told it was England.
London, England.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't matter. This is at a time when, like, a movie would cut to China, and so you knew it was really China. The music would go, din-din-din-din-din-din-din.
They're still doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, not just China.
No. Right.
Have you watched the new Jack Ryan?
No, I haven't yet.
Oh.
Does it start with, like, the call to prayer every time they cut to the east, doesn't it?
No. I mean, leaving aside all of its problems, there was one moment where they have to go to Paris for reasons.
Right, sure.
And, of course, they arrive in Paris, and the motorcade, which is taking them from the airport to, like, downtown police station, drives past the Eiffel Tower.
Sure.
I mean, I've been to Paris.
Yeah.
The Eiffel Tower is literally not on the way to anywhere.
It's on the way to the Eiffel Tower.
The Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. Sorry, I stepped on your joke. I'm sorry.
Fucking Yanks. Just, seriously, read a map. Just get a globe.
Just put loads of mimes in the background on bikes with baguettes in the basket. That's how I would do it.
It's how they did it in Team America. But anyway, back to...
So Connery, it was actually his idea to shoot that conversation with Ness that we talked about before in the church.
Yep.
So it was originally going to be in the police department. And Connery said, well, like, the whole of Chicago is on the take, right? So the whole of Chicago is owned by Capone. So the only safe place he could think to go would be to a church, which is why they sat in that church. It's an incredible scene. Like, we said that piece of dialogue earlier, you know, he pulls a knife, pulls a gun. Have you ever taken a blood oath? I'm doing all sorts of weird acts. I'm a pirate now. You ever taken a blood oath?
I think you're Mr. Cornish. Ness.
All pirates are Cornish. Do a pirate accent, they do a Cornish accent. They're the same.
All right.
Also farmers. Anyway. So the close-up of Malone and Ness in the blood oath scene is actually a director trademark. Get ready to fade me out. And it is using a split focus diopter.
A what?
A split focus diopter.
Oh, split focus.
A split focus.
But it said split focus.
So they hold up a half convex lens in front of the camera so that both characters in foreground and background are in. You're already laughing because you're going to fade this out, aren't you? They're both in focus. But De Palma uses this in a lot of his films. Scorsese uses it to great effect in Cape Fear as well. Really, really good, actually. So the result is that you have both characters in focus, but one feels much closer, which is why you get that great dichotomy of them sat in the pew like that. I can say anything at this point, because you'll have faded me out.
No.
Sure. Brian De Palma's used it loads. I can sneak a bit in.
It's fine, you ran out a bit. That's it, you've had your bit.
Connery had also never been squibbed before.
As in...
Yeah, so squibs, blood for pack. Listeners that don't know, are little tiny explosives that they put on you, and they go bang, and they've got a blood pack in front of them, and blood explodes out of you. They also use squibs if you, like, when they fire guns against a wall and a spark pops up. That's a squib as well. They actually use paintballs now with like a special type of metal.
Hang on, he was James Bond and he was never Squib.
When does James Bond get shot?
Oh yeah, true.
It's James Bond. Or he gets shot in the shoulder and his shoulder goes red. Maybe, maybe. I don't think he even does. So anyway, so he wasn't fucking happy because he's Sean Connery. And when they all went off, because it was like, he got loads of dust and blood in his eyes and insisted on going to the hospital. So they took him to the hospital and then they made him do it again. But still, the scene is very, very good.
If you look carefully, when he actually, the scribbles on the back go, yeah. And he falls down, you can see he's actually wearing safety goggles.
Yeah, and if you look, he's very, at his mouth, he just says, fuck you, as if you look in slow motion. So they had to go to the hospital because he was not very happy at all. But otherwise, from what I understand, had a grand time.
A grand old time.
According to the official making of that I've watched on the Blu-ray. I just love once
pretty
to
sure
watch a Blu-ray reaction when they're like, this is fucking bullshit. Unless it's like a famously bad film when they're like, oh no, this is fucking worst. Like they're all laughing. Anyway, that brings us to Charles Martin Smith.
Charlie Smith.
Charlie Smith plays Wallace.
Oh, right, yes.
So they saw him in American Graffiti and they wanted him straight away. He's a great actor. He's been in a million things, of which I can't name because he's that guy that's good in stuff. He also directed those dolphin tail movies. You have him, that dolphin born in the wild and he's got like a deformed tail. So he, like a marine biologist builds him like a prosthetic tail.
You
and
can't,
like,
you can't hear this,
a child.
But the look I'm giving him is currently roughly translated into... What?
It came out just after the Flipper film came out and people were loving dolphins.
Why do you even think I would know about that?
It's just interesting. Don't you find this interesting? Oh, this is why
Not
I
really.
Do this one. This is why I do this one. This is why
no,
I do this. No,
no,
I'm with you.
I mean, deformed dolphin? That seems cruel.
It's all fucked up, man. Anyway.
Willie was bad enough. You know they didn't, right? They locked him up after every shoot.
He kept getting caught as well. What a stupid fucking thing. They should put him down. So Charlie Martin Smith, he wasn't comfortable with being the comic relief. But Brian De Palma was like, your death is going to have more impact if you are slightly more lighthearted, like you're a man out of the office, like that kind of stuff. A lot of that stuff was actually come up by him. So like him whooping and stuff on the horse. I'm so glad to be alive. When he like, and he hits the guy with a shotgun. That's all him like living into the character. I think he's really, really good. His death has a lot of impact. It's very sad. He fucking writes touchable on the fucking lift and shit. Some fucked up shit. Some fucked
up
shit.
Evil.
Yeah, fucked up shit.
I mean, the thing I like about Wallace, to be honest, is he's super passionate about the whole... And they do lay it on a little bit thick. It's like, yeah, we
Do you carry
know.
A badge?
No,
Did
no.
Do you carry a gun?
No, we get that they got Capone for tax evasion.
Sure.
Right? Everybody knew that. They lay it on a little bit thick in the movie, but it's the fact that he's like, oh my God, these accounts are insane.
They do lay it on a bit thick.
The fact that he is so passionate about the accounts... A bit like you with this budget section that I assume is coming shortly.
Oh, it's going to be good. It's not.
And then he finally comes out of himself.
Yeah.
And then somebody shoots him in the face.
And like when he's walking that Steadicam shot, which is amazing, when he's taking the witness, he's walking down the hall and he's like, oh, it's much, much better being a field agent. Like he's so like finding his stride. You feel so glad for him. And then
and
boom.
Then all you see is Nitty looks up, the doors close.
You know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen. I mean, and he's the everyman as well, right? So, like, everybody roots. It's the kind of the one that you can, like, feel. He's, like, the most normal guy. He's not a crusader. He's not, like, a hardened beat cop. He's not, like, a crazy marksman Italian guy. He's just, like, a dude who works in an office who's become this adventuring Avenger. It's good. So, the last member of our Untouchables, there were 9 in real life, but fuck that in this film. I mean, Steven Soderbergh did 11, and then he did 12. And then, anyway, the last one. Is Andy Garcia.
Yeah.
And he originally was sought out by Brian De Palma for the role of Nitty. And he was like, oh no, can I want to do Stone. And De Palma was like, nah. And he was like, yeah. And he was like, nah. I'm just injecting drama because I haven't got much in Andy Garcia. And he was like, nah. And he was like, yeah. And he was like, nah. And he was like, yeah. And then he insisted and then he did. Then he got it for Stone.
Is that it?
And he's amazing. He's amazing in it.
Yeah, well, he's Andy Garcia.
Because I haven't got much on this, I also wanted to point out he's the only Oscar-nominated conjoined twin in history.
Point out again, right?
Shit.
We did Ocean's 11. You didn't think this came up?
I've got to stop getting drunk during this podcast. That brings us to Capone.
It's a big chicken.
Big old Big Cap, they called him. They called him the Big One, the Big Cap One, they called him. The Big Old Cap One.
Okay, we've done that. Also Capon.
They called him Captain Caper. Captain Caper One, they got it anyway.
Captain Caper.
So originally they wanted Bob Hoskins. And he was cast.
What?
He was cast, damn you.
Oh, no.
He was like,
"All
right, son,
no.
I'm Al Capone. Where's Roger Rabbit? I'm going to fuck him." No, he wanted to fuck his wife. Anyway, so...
To be fair, most people wanted to fuck his wife.
I mean, that's true. Have you seen Bob Hoskins' wife? Oh, we're talking about other people. Anyway...
I assume she is actually Jessica Rabbit, right?
I would like to think so. I think she'd be quite terrifying in real life. If she was a person, you'd be like, "Ah, get away from me, you big red-headed freak."
Anatomical problems, like the there's no way there's no room bitties. In that waist.
It's true. She'd have chronic back tract. Problems. Oh.
Yeah.
She'd be in leg braces at the age of 16. Which would, weird way, would make her more fuckable. Well, we've made this podcast a requisite amount of gross. Let's move on to more academic things, shall we?
So, Hoskins...
Hoskins
was cast.
He was cast because they were like, there's no way we could afford Bobby De Niro. That's what we call him, his friends, Bobby De Niro. And so...
really? I'm just... to me, he's just Bob.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, well. I was going to make a joke about you sucking his dick or something, but hey, whatever, let's move on. But Brian De Palma, after the big old spiel of, like, these are the people we've cast, was like, how about this? How about, this is the budget bit, get ready. If you don't extend the budget from 20 million to 25, dun, dun, dun. So to pay Robert De Niro, then I'm going to walk. And weirdly, it worked. Oh, man, do you feel better now you know about the budget? I do.
Not really.
So they extended the budget $5 million to pay Robert De Niro.
You do have the budget in there, right?
Yeah, 25 million. It was 20 and it was 25.
No, like the whole breakdown.
Yeah.
Because our listeners demand more.
15 million for sandwiches for Mr.
You
Connery.
You keep trying to move on. You are not addressing the point.
I'm doing it now. Would you let me finish?
Sorry. Go on.
3 million for pot noodles for Mr. Garcia. £25 for a couple of bumps of coke for De Palma, just so he could remember what it was like. And £15 for costumes to Giorgio Armani.
About right.
That adds up to 25, right?
Why not?
Improv. Anyway, so they got De Niro.
You forgot that the fake blood was actually donated by the Heinz Corporation.
No, fake blood was just, they stole blood from a blood bank. This is a robbery! They said, this is a bank robbery, hey!
Really awkward moment the first time it was a sperm bank.
But unfortunately,
my counter said, come on, mate.
They were like, sorry, mate, a tornado's just come through here. There's a gum twister. If you can catch it, go nuts. Did we cut that out of the last one or no?
No, we actually used it twice.
Perfect.
Because apparently we are both teenagers.
Gum twister! Anyway, so Robert De Niro put on as much weight as he could in 3 months, because, you know, method in it. But he couldn't put enough on, so he got it on the jowls, which is why he's got that big old fat melon. But he didn't put enough on his body, so they had to put padding in all his suits.
I bet that really pissed him off.
I bet it did. Bobby De Niro being so method. He also tracked down all of Capone's real tailors to get him to make replicas of his actual clothes, including the silk underwear that he wore. And he made the production pay for the silk underwear that was obviously never going to be shown because he's so method. But it's Robert De Niro, so go for your life, mate. It's cool, isn't it?
It's good to know that actually there is one bit of this entire movie that is as authentic as it could have been.
Well, actually, the Barbasol set at the beginning of the film is a set, but a lot of the items within that room were actually owned by Al Capone. So the Capone's estate gave, like, bottles of aftershave and razors and stuff like that.
Is that
so
why
shit
there's
on
a
the 12-inch
table? Black rubber cock just in the back of the shot?
Why does it have to be black, man? Why does it have to be black?
It's shiny.
Okay, it pops better on camera.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, that was cool. Way to ruin a nice bit of trivia that I had for you. Anyway, so talking of costumes.
Go
look
on.
How seamless it is this month, eh? It's almost like I put some effort into my notes. Marilyn Vance was a costume designer, and she was nominated for an Oscar.
Which she did not win.
Which she did not win. But she used to work
that,
for one Mr. Giorgio Armani.
Oh.
OMG, bro.
You know you've already set this up by saying
yeah,
that.
I know, yeah, I know, yeah, I said it earlier.
Yeah.
So anyway, so he made all the Untouchables costumes.
Yep.
To make him look super cool, and frankly did a fucking great job. They look pimp.
I think, to be honest, he also made them look pretty authentic.
Yeah.
Because that whole 20s, like... It's basically, you work your way down from the top, right? So you start with the hat, and the hat is badass.
Before you talk about Connery, his wasn't made by Giorgio Armani.
No. So you start with the hat is badass, and then you come down, you've got the collar, and you've got the kind of whole shirt tie bit, going on. And then you've got the, like, double rest wide lapel thing.
Yeah, it looks cool.
And then you kind of work your way down, and you realise, actually, oh, the shirt actually looks a bit like sackcloth. Yeah. And the jacket just keeps going. Then you get down to the trousers, which are basically two sacks that have been glued together.
Yeah. They're really, really baggy. Yeah, well, that was the style at the time, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also, I don't think it's terribly period
authentic.
By the
time you get to shoes,
it looks really cool.
Armani has them basically just kicking their way into a dead dog on
but
each
But the
foot.
Overcoats look fucking fantastic, though. Yeah. I mean, they look really good. I mean, I don't think that's actually how people dress in their 20s. Maybe if they had an enormous amount of money, but it looks fucking great.
It's not far off.
This movie, and we'll come back to this later when I start yelling about the one-star reviews, but this movie is not about historical accuracy. But anyway.
No.
So, Marilyn Vance was quite pissed off because the credit in the film is costumes by Giorgio Armani, and he actually made three. Because when they said to Sean Connery, oh, Giorgio Armani is going to make a costume, isn't this exciting? He went, sounds fucking ridiculous. I'll make my own costume. So just went to the props department and picked out a load of clothes and was like, dish. Dish will douche. He was douching at the time, but he was like, also the shoot will be good.
Well,
aye, Vigor. Where am I from?
You know, that's a better Russian accent than he has in October.
Yes, true. That is good. Yeah. Victor 9. I learned Russian from Star Trek. So she was annoyed, but she was nominated. But she didn't win.
So she was annoyed, she was elated, and then she was annoyed again.
It was bad, and then she killed us. It's not a funny joke. Really bad.
No.
Cut that out.
Beep, beep, beep.
Talking of costumes, it's funny. All the hats had to have their brims slightly shortened so that it didn't cover their eyes for the camera.
Yeah, because they were big hats.
They were big old fedoras.
Proper fedora.
So they had to snip, snip, snip. They had to give them the old hat circumcision.
Which does explain why the hats look a little bit, like, off.
Yeah, exactly. That's why a lot of the time they wear them back on their heads, not like on properly. So my last few bits are on just general production-y bits, because this is a lush film. It's got some delicious sets.
It's got some really, really nice cinematography.
It has. Got some extremely nice. And they had to be super careful because it was, obviously, Chicago, quite a modern city. So they had to like shoot around all the enormous skyscrapers, which is why it's all funny angles when they're outside.
But they do a very good job.
They do a really good job of making it look period. All the period cars and stuff look really great.
And really there is, great. I think there's what it's where they go into the post office, where you're coming up like a main boulevard.
Yeah.
That must have cost them a freaking fortune.
Yeah. It's really good.
Nowadays, they just CGI it.
I think they were quite lucky in terms of Chicago at that time. It's got a lot of like 10s and 20s architecture. So there were certain shots where they were like, oh, that's okay, or we can just put a matte painting in the background maybe or something.
I mean,
like that.
There are a couple of bits that you spot. There's like fairly obvious where they've retextured what is clearly a cement upright.
Yeah.
And they put on some...
And like the hotel that Capone lives in is the Lexington Hotel, which they've totally redressed, but it was still built in the 1910s, so they've just taken down all the 80s dressings. Malone's house is an actual location that they've extensively redressed to make it look period. I think they put too many photos in it myself, but that's fine. But yeah, I think they do an incredible job of really making it look really period. The sequence when they go to Canada, there's not actually a bridge over a river on the border to Canada.
Did they go to Mexico?
No, they went to Montana. So they had to find a 1020s period bridge that was cool looking. Because it's like a cool thing, right? It's like a dramatic thing that there's a bridge between the border. It's not just like two dudes with guns stood at a toll booth. It's like a much more dramatic thing if they have to cross
the bridge. Also, it does help with the whole scene.
Yeah, when they're being cowboys.
If they could just go in any direction, then it wouldn't have worked, would it?
Of course. So, I mean, that scene was put in, like I said before, to like wake up the audience. But all the Mounties were locals. There's just people that live near the bridge. They were just like, can you ride a horse? Can you wear a red coat and a big hat? Then you're a Mountie. And they all got paid. And I think that scene works gangbusters. I love that scene. And I think it does really refresh you in the middle of the film. I think it works very, very well.
I don't know. I think it's... Yeah. It's strange. It feels a little out of place.
It feels a bit false, because, like, why are they all suddenly able to ride horses and shit? But
it does wonders for character dev, as you said. It's also... They do need a win at that point.
Yeah. And it's part of, like, that music, like, when we were watching it last night, Carolina, my wife, was saying, like, the music is so, like, over the top, like, triumph, heroes triumphing. And but it's good, and it's the same as in the post office thing. It's like, you like, when they score that, when they get those big scores against Capone, it feels like a big triumph moment, and the music is part, I mean, it's Ennio Morricone, who's pretty much unrivaled soundtrack-wise. I've no doubt you'll disagree, but
No, I would say that actually amazing. He is pretty much tip-top, and highlight for this particular movie, slight sidebar, Capone's theme.
It's well good, yeah.
That kind of mix of, and it's a little bit modern.
Yeah, it
but
is.
But it's also, you've got the full kind of like gravelly wah-wah trumpets. And
yeah. So he incorporated a lot of Duke Ellington's jazz into that to like give it a period feel. But it really does, it gives that real good like
Is that steady cam shot again where you're following the breakfast tray up the stairs?
Yeah, so good. Because you're following the breakfast tray, he goes to the bookkeeper, puts a bit of paper in, he's got that ridiculous cigar.
And then it comes through, and the brilliant final thing is him with the cigar in and bed. Who smokes a cigar in bed?
That's cut from the steps of the Lexington Hotel, and then it cuts to, and all of that's a set. So the office and the bedroom, that's all a set. So bloody lush and so beautiful. The other piece of music I really love is like the child's music box, like lullaby from the Union Station. I think that works really well.
No.
You don't like it?
We'll get back to that one. Go on.
But De Palma actually really hated that and fought against it. And Ennio Morricone was like, fuck you, Ennio Morricone. So anyway, talking of the train station, see what I did there, train station moment.
Great, we're going to sidebar straight into this then.
It's an homage to Battleship Potemkin. Have you ever seen that?
No.
So it's a Russian movie in the...
I know what it is.
Right. So there's a scene
that
in that
what you asked.
Where there's like Russians... shooting the crew of the Battleship Potemkin, shooting a shitload of... civilians on the Odessa steps, and there's a woman at the top with a pram that's teetering on the edge the whole time, and blah 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 blah. Falls down through the crowd while they're all being massacred, etc. etc. Let's just be really dismissive about this real thing that happens. Originally in the script, it was a train chase, as in one train chasing another train, which then crashed into each other, which then led to a shootout. So, couldn't afford that because. What?
Spent too much money on Sean Connery's outfit.
Yeah. Robert De Niro's salary. So they were like, let's just do it on the steps at Union Station. So they shot at night at Union Station. And this will just feed into you're not a big fan of this scene. He just made up the shots as they went along. This is what we're going to do. And he just made them move the cameras around and relight it and was like, this
That's
is what we're going to do.
Why I don't like the scene.
Why don't you like the scene? Or do you want to do this at the recommendation? Oh,
all right,
reviews?
Fine. No, let's just get it out of the way because it's not a massive deal breaker for me. It doesn't change how I feel about the film.
You
as
hate
a whole.
White people. That's what it is, isn't it?
I hate babies. No.
You hate babies that don't look small enough to need to be in that pram.
Right. There are three main problems with that scene.
Right.
One of them is in terms of frustration with the character. But Ness should have just stayed fucking put, right?
But you get that he's just had a baby, right?
Yeah.
And he's left his wife alone with the baby.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh no, it's a baby!
Yeah, and she was doing just fine.
Oh, I don't know.
She was clunking up the steps and what have you.
He was mansplaining, saving him.
No. Should have stayed put. I mean, literally,
no,
he's there to bring down the reason that baby might get blown up.
And he's also meant to be there and not draw attention to himself.
It's a complete lack of focus from somebody who should have been completely focused.
Yeah.
Right, the other two are... The lead-in is... It's so frickin' obvious.
When they're all, like, looking at each other with side-eye.
Well, no, it's also the fact that you kind of, you know, see him and then you keep cutting back to her and it's like, well, clearly something's going to go wrong with the bloody baby.
Yeah, it's so telegraphed. It's massively telegraphed.
Unbelievably telegraphed.
Once it kicks off, I do think it is amazing.
Thirdly...
All them sailors, oh, they all get killed.
Thirdly...
Mm-hmm. All them sailors.
It's too long. The lead-in is too long.
Fair enough.
Because what you want there is you want the tense waiting of a stakeout.
I think it plays out too long so that the tension dissipates when it should be. It comes to a crescendo and then wanes. Yeah, it builds and then it wanes and it should have just built and then,
It
should have
been okay, now this is a thing about chivalry, apparently. Yeah.
And then you should have all the cool stuff of Andy Garcia skidding and throwing a gun and all that kind of stuff.
The minute he lets go of that pram, literally the minute the first shot is fired, it's oh, thank fuck, that's over.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And that's why I hate that scene.
And not, oh, thank fuck, that's happening because it breaks attention. Yeah. It's just gone on to... That's fair criticism.
Also, ham-fisted.
Well, they did it on the... Yeah, I know. They really need to get rid of the my baby
bit. They just need to cut that.
Yeah, they do.
You don't need to do it.
No.
We
know it's her baby.
You're distraught.
Otherwise, what? We might think that she kidnapped that baby?
Just have her, like, falling to her knees next to Ness as he's blasting the shit out.
And what's she do when she's down on his knees?
I don't know.
Next to him.
She's just had a kid. She's hormonal.
So anything could have happened.
Just running down the list, by the way.
Our producer's looking. What are you? I'm trying to say. I was going to say she was going to pray. Weird. I think he was suggesting that she might suck his dick. That would be
sick,
weird,
man.
That's
sick.
Jesus Christ! This is why we don't let you on mic, you sick fuck.
Right.
So I've got one last bit, and it's the original ending. I've got one last bit for you, Rob.
Hang on. Wait, what?
I'm going to give you the original ending. I'm going to give you the last inch.
The OG. Nope.
Podcast over.
The OG ending.
The OG ending. The original ending was Capone in his barber chair with the towel around his face, but in tight on his face, and then the camera being interviewed by interviewers, and then the camera pulls up to reveal that he's in his jail cell.
Yes.
I quite like that.
That would have worked.
They basically ran out of time and money, and they were like, fuck it, let's just not do it. But I think
also,
that's a really
fair,
good bookend.
De Niro would have demanded that he went to find a genuine 30s tailor to make the suit.
He wanted $800,000 more.
Yeah.
For like a day shooting. I think it would have been well good, but Robert De Niro, greedy. So you said to me earlier, oh, Mike, did they make a sequel? What were they going to do? Like, oh my God, aren't they going to remake it?
I wish
Zack Snyder would remake it, or preferably,
you were like,
I wish McGee, the director of the Charlie's Angels films, which I know you love, I wish he would remake it. It was so good. Did you see that movie?
I'm pretty sure
Gangster
that this
Squad?
Is a fantasy in your own tiny little mind.
I don't know. Well, you were bottomless, but weirdly not topless. Anyway, there was talk of a prequel that De Palma was going to make.
Okay.
And it was called The Untouchables, colon. Came too close to the mic, sorry. Capone
colon.
Rising.
Oh.
And do you know who was going to star as a young Al Capone? Nicholas motherfucking Cage.
Yes.
Shockingly, they couldn't find funding. So what we're asking is that all of our listeners give £50,000 each.
We're going to start a GoFundMe.
Oh, wait, how many listeners have we got? £100,000 each.
We're going to start a GoFundMe because
we
want to see Nicolas Cage as a young Al Capone.
More importantly, Nicolas Cage is a young Robert De Niro. And then I would like a fan edit of Godfather 2 where De Niro plays a young Marlon Brando and then Cage plays a young... Oh, this is embarrassing. I've got an enormous erection. I've got a mid-size. I've
Capone
got a small
rising.
Erection. Oh, no, my Capone is rising. Let's get that clean so it sounds like I made that joke up. Oh, no, my Capone. No, it's just too late. So that's it on my sequels and remakes, because that was all there was.
Because they didn't.
There was a SNES game.
There was.
It was described by Nintendo Life as should have had utilization of the Super Scope. Is it Super Scope?
Yeah.
Super Scope. To make
thing.
The shooting more responsive. Because, yeah, an enormous plastic tube on your shoulder when you're meant to be firing a handgun, that would have been better, I'm sure.
You could totally shoot from the hip, but never mind.
I just remembered that, reading that, and I think I sort of lost opportunity because I got nothing more on that. Anyway, recommendations.
Oh, this is going to be tricky.
The first one straight off the bat is JFK.
Yep.
What's JFK with Kevin Costner in it? It's fucking great. And Kevin Costner essentially plays, well, he's Kevin Costner, all-American guy. Watch the first half of Man of Steel when he's Superman's dad. It's great. But then turn it off, because then it's bad.
Watch The Bodyguard.
Watch The Bodyguard. Watch Glenn Ross.
Watch either The Postman or Waterworld.
Watch a director's cut of Waterworld, because it's an hour and a half longer, and I hate our listeners.
It needed to be an hour and a half longer, to be fair.
So
it was
good.
Not long enough.
He pees in that machine and water comes out. Watch All the President's Men.
Yes.
It's a great... and in, like, lots of 70s, like... I think there's a feel of like a 70s and 80s big epics, like 3 Days of the Condor and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Those are great movies. Watch all the Brian De Palma movies, Body Double, Carrie, Raising Kane, Mission Impossible, all those ones we talked about earlier. Watch The Godfather 2. Because it's got Robert De Niro in it.
See
if it's Brian Nicolas Cage. Watch Raging Bull if you want to see Robert De Niro transform his body again.
Watch any Robert De Niro film from the last decade if you want to know what happens when you stop giving a shit because you've got more money than God.
Jesus
and
Christ.
Are still wearing the silk boxers that you had made for you in The Untouchables.
And Connery-wise, Highlander 2.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
It's another movie where he plays another nationality but just keeps a Scottish accent. I'm an Egyptian Japanese guy.
Hunt for Red October.
Hunt for Red October, yes, sorry, of course. Glaring mistake.
That's good.
And, as always...
Hang on. I would say that there is one that if you want kind of, like, major classic set piece...
beautifully built, enormous, epic sets.
Yeah, like, crazy good.
Great sound design.
I've forgotten what it's called.
Committed actors. And it's very much a good guys versus bad guys narrative.
Yeah.
You could say that they're untouchable, but much like the untouchable, there's a theme of them becoming more, not corrupt, but them loosening their morals to get what they need. What are you prepared to do? Do you know what that movie is?
No.
Mr. Bean in Hollywood. No, it's Event Horizon, you dumbass. Come on, man. We've been doing this for probably too long. Nah, we do this forever. We'll die doing this podcast, Rob. Mostly because you'll kill us both.
Oh, it won't be me. Our listeners will eventually work out where we are.
They'll rise up.
They're looking for us right now.
And we'll probably die of exhaustion of all the blowjobs. So our reviews.
Our reviews?
Our reviews.
Now, what is this out of?
Five touches. Oh, no, that means I need to give it zero because they're untouchable. Nope, that doesn't work. Five Tommy guns. Five bottles of whiskey.
Oh, that's, okay.
I feel like this is something we should have worked out ahead of time. And by we, I mean me.
Or me.
Five Pagliacci's.
Right, so either way, out of five.
Out of five.
Something.
I'm going to give it... I want to say four.
But?
But I feel like I want to say 3.5.
Ooh.
Can I say 3.75?
You can.
3.8.
It's our podcast.
I'm going to say 3.8. Yeah.
That's in madness.
It's almost a four, but ooh.
Okay, 3.8.
3.8.
Go on.
No, I want to hear yours.
Well, no, because why are you giving it 3.8?
It feels a bit idealized.
Okay.
There are various things which are... It takes a lot of liberties. But let's see your rating, because I have no doubt that you've got something
so,
to say on the same thing.
If this were a pure work of fiction...
Sure.
True and saying. This is very important.
Yeah, I know what
you're
going to say.
It would probably get about a 3.84-ish. The trouble is, it's not.
Ooh.
And...
We are going to have a disagreement during one-star reviews, my friend.
As a result, I can give it... It's got to get more than 2.5, because it's a solid film. It probably doesn't get much more than 3.
Really?
Yeah.
The historical accuracy annoys you that much?
The trouble is that if you're telling a story that you've written...
But that's just it. They are telling a story that they've written.
No.
No one said it was a documentary.
Doesn't matter. This actually happened. And...
So what?
You can take liberties. You can have, like, an entire raid that didn't exist. You can have 4 instead of 9. And what have you.
Characters didn't exist, or he could be caught in the wrong way, or Ness can be completely portrayed incorrectly, or
yeah,
the cars can be made 5 years after the film is actually set.
Yeah. my biggest problem with it is they make a very big point of making a bad guy, and they make that bad guy very bad.
Are you talking about Nitty?
Yeah.
Right.
And they make sure that bad guy comes to a sticky end, because
sure.
He has to.
Played with... Serious gravitas by Billy Drago, by the way.
Yeah.
What a legit genre legend. Oh, Billy Drago, what a legend.
And the trouble is, that's a step too far, because not only was he not a particularly bad guy, he was a bit of a gangster and what have you, but he wasn't like...
Sure, I mean, he was a psycho as much as any of them were a psycho, sure.
But also, he didn't die.
So there's... I agree, there's no reason to make that character Nitty, because Nitty, as you know, he
picked a name.
He actually took over the Chicago outfit after Al Capone. He actually ended up killing himself in 1943. He got into a war with another Chicago gang and was given an out by the FBI, where he was basically, like, he wasn't going to win this war.
Did you know, by the way, that the other Chicago gang that got into the war with later became the Chicago arm of the Girl Scouts of America?
Nice try!
Not really.
Did they operate out of the Pivotal Tower? But you know Nitty's family owned a pizzeria that invented the Chicago pizza?
Yeah.
Shit. It's also not true. That's your new tactic, isn't it? Just say yes. Shit. Anyway, that was a good one. But no, so he was given an out by the FBI to say if you inform on people, then you can blah, blah, blah. So instead he killed himself. Which people are like, oh, he's a Chicago legend because he's so honourable. Also a mass murdering prick, let's be real.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, Chicagoans who are listening to us.
We're not big in Chicago.
And, like, Wallace is based on Frank Wilson, who's an IRS agent, who had nothing to do with the Untouchables. He was in the same task force but never met Ness, and he's the one that actually took them down. Ness's Untouchables, outside of, like, raiding, like, booze caches and stuff like that, never really touched the sides. Capone-wise, they were very publicised and did a lot of flashy stuff. All that stuff of Ness, what are you going to do when Prohibition is over? I think I'll take a drink. He, like, died a penniless alcoholic. By the time that by the time he was in the Untouchables time-wise in this film, he was married three times, he had no kids. He killed someone because he got drunk and drove a car and ran him over. Like, he went on to try and catch a serial killer in Cleveland. I'm going to get the lift music again, aren't I? He couldn't catch them, and they vilified him. So, like, he went from this huge hero to being vilified and had his reputation destroyed and all that kind of stuff, and he died a penniless alcoholic.
Yeah.
So, you know,
easy, that's a movie I'd watch.
That's nice. Brian Michael Bendis wrote an amazing comic about the torso killer and that and the fall of Elliot Ness, which I highly recommend.
There we go.
You should read that.
Good. But yeah, so for those reasons, and also the fact
but also,
that as much as...
You want, like, Fist in the Air triumph, don't you? That's
no.
the thing.
I mean, this is the thing.
From
is,
this film, you do.
No.
Okay.
Nobody won.
Fine.
In the 20s. Nobody won
and
in the 20s Chicago.
And, like, taking Al Capone out did nothing.
No, did not change a fucking thing.
He was so far gone from syphilis at this point that it didn't matter anyway. More capable people just took over. But yeah. No.
Capone not rising anymore.
I feel like we should do an Al Capone podcast. We apparently both know a fair bit.
Anyway.
Yeah.
To give him his due, there are a couple of bits that we haven't talked about, and there are the overhead shots.
Yeah,
so like
amazing.
The crane shots he'll pull up and what have you,
sure,
and you
yeah.
see everything just laid out perfectly. There's beautiful symmetry have you, and the set.
The set design is stunning. So this, like, the set design is one of those things. Every time I watch this film, it makes me feel like an old person because I always say they actually don't make films like this anymore.
No,
because they don't. Because it's just not practical to make films like this anymore.
But the trouble is, as much as that side of things, the physical side of the actual film is beautiful. The plot and what have you, blah, 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 blah. So. Yeah. It comes out better than even.
No, fair enough. Yeah. So, those are our reviews. So, I was going to say, not many people agree with us. But actually, no, people gave them 1-star reviews.
Well, okay.
This is the first time it made me angry, but we've already discussed that. So, let's do it anyway.
Yeah, right.
It's Amazon 1-star reviews.
Our first review is from Dominic from January 2017, who said, I had to fast forward through much of it. Which means, fuck you, don't leave a review, you haven't watched a film, eat shit.
Why?
You can't leave a review of a movie you haven't watched.
No, does he give a reason?
Oh, sorry. He says, Cosner was barely... I thought he was saying why to me. I was like, how dare you? Anyway, Cosner was barely reading through his lines in this poorly written material. Incorrect. The script is amazing. With slow-moving and preposterous scenes. Also incorrect. I don't think it tracks.
No, we definitely
and
does not drag.
This is an opinion thing. I'm right. That's why people listen to this podcast. Anyway, there's no such thing as subjective in
you
the world.
You know how to move fast.
It's true. And talk fast.
And come fast.
And slim fast. Nope.
Great, now we're going to have to pay them again.
That's why slim fast. Just don't say the name of that chip that has to make you play that noise, but it just went out of my head.
Oh, good.
The TV series was far more entertaining
you mean
than
Intel.
This. That's it, Intel. The TV series was far more entertaining than this overall big disappointment. I haven't watched the TV series. Fuck you, man. That's my retort.
When the TV series didn't even make the recommendations or the sequels. We haven't talked about it until this point.
Because
it must have been terrible.
Brian De Palma and David Mamet, the studio, said, we want you to make the TV series but a film. And they were like, nah, shit. They were literally like, we got together and we were like, no, shit, we're not doing that. So they didn't. So shut up, Dominic.
What a douche.
That one's a bit tenuous because he just doesn't like the film. This one is incredibly long, so I'll skip on to the second one first. This one's by Artemis Fowl. It's the name of a
character
from a
book. A kid's
yeah. So I tried to look up his other reviews, and I don't know if people are onto us or not, but it was locked to only certain viewers, and I couldn't look at his other 47 reviews.
I mean, it could be the real Artemis Fowl. So something he'd do.
After our previous conversation, it might be you. Because he says, factually incorrect. Facts conjured up for dramatic effect. This movie is lame. Yes. Facts conjured up for dramatic effect.
Let's run through this. Factually incorrect, yes. Yep. Facts conjured up for dramatic effect, yes. This movie is lame, no.
No. Fair dues. De Niro's Capone is a one-dimensional character, while Cosner's Ness is naive, ignorant babe in the woods. Probably an argument for that. Almost unwatchable, not an argument for that. The story is sloppy slash incoherent. I think it's pretty straightforward. It sticks together pretty well.
Yeah,
whether you think the story is good or bad.
Oh my god, what's going on?
There's no plot holes. This is not the thinking man's gangster movie.
That I would have to agree with.
But also, if I may, shut up. It's not the thinking man's gangster. Fair enough. I know, and that's fair dues.
I mean, he judges himself as a thinking man.
Surely.
Having named himself after a character who is a 9-year-old boy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right, right? It's out of a series of children's books, right?
Yeah.
This is not the thinking man's gangster movie. What is? So Godfather, the Mafia's not like that at all until The Godfather came out, when they started adopting all of the customs of The Godfather because they were so impressed by it, right? Goodfellas, same deal. Gomorrah, maybe?
Mm.
So Artemis Fowl, if you're out there, you son of a bitch, I want you on this podcast so you can tell me what a thinking man's gangster movie is.
Justify yourself, Fowl.
If our listeners think they know of a thinking man's gangsters movie, then tell me, because, I mean, what, Carlito's Way? I mean, it's all Scarface, it's all crazy, overblown, because that's why films are films, not documentaries, which are also good. So anyway.
And our final one-star review.
It's long.
Do you want to
take a break? This is by Ray.
Ray.
She's taken time out for being in the second best Star Wars movie, Last Jedi. Do you write a... Oh, you see his hackles go up. He's like a cat. What was De Palma thinking? Well, we already covered that. He wanted to make a commercial successful movie so he could make his own movie.
And succeeded, no less.
So shut up, Ray. The end. No. She says, I've not seen the... Sorry, I'll read it properly. I have not seen the DVD of this film.
Right.
But watched the video.
Okay, when's this from?
2001.
Fair.
Well, it's nearly 20 years ago. Fuck, yeah. I've enjoyed many De Palma films. Oh, no, it's many De Palma films, not many De Palma film. It's not like an Italian. Anyway, and heard good things about this one. The movie was all right until Sean Connery death scene, and it was all downhill from there. He received about 7 rounds in the chest area and still lived long enough to give Costner the case-winning clue. Yeah, right. It was you, wasn't it? Capone was featured in all about 5 scenes. 3, 4. Which was disappointing. Well, yeah, but it's not about him, is it? It's the film's called The Untouchables. It focuses on The Untouchables! Anyway, dialogue was repeated over and over. For instance, it's nice being married, huh? Yes, it's a recurring motif in the film about the importance of him not wanting married people with family and Untouchables, because he knows he's going to get killed. You've missed the point of the film, you fucking dumbass. Maybe you should stick to swinging a lightsaber around on a rock with seal nuns. Now, I don't like The Last Jedi because of this. They were repeated about 5 times, which totally grated on my nerves.
Ooh.
The shot
How
of the...
How do you spell grated?
G-R-A-T-E-D?
That's right.
That's right, yeah. The shot, there's no capital letters, I should mention. The shot of the guy being falling off the roof screaming with the sky behind him was so cheesy. Yes, it was 1987, and they had to do it on a blue screen. Also, Elliot Ness makes a point of saying, if they're going to uphold the law, then they have to do it by example. Then you see Sean Connery pouring himself a shot and beating up cops. Horrible, horrible, horrible. I don't even know why I sat through the whole thing. So she hasn't understood that he makes that point at the beginning of the film, and at the end, they're compromising their values in order to catch Capone. You know, character development, you fucking art.
Also, Connery's not there.
He's not there at the beginning, it's quite true. Yeah.
And it's clear that Connery, as a full-blooded Irish Scotsman...
And he says throughout the whole film, he says throughout the whole film, what are you prepared to do? Everything within the confines of the law, and what else? So, don't come to me not understanding the film, and the right goddamn thing, and the goddamn thing. These are the first time one-star reviews have actively fucking pissed me off. They never understand the movie, but to actually articulate it like a child, written in crayon on Amazon. Furious.
So there we have it. The Untouchables. Touchable, but only by morons on Amazon.
I'm so angry, Rob.
The one thing we didn't get into, by the way, is can I just point out that for the time that this was made, this was like super violent.
Made the same year as RoboCop.
Yeah, it's like that got that really gritty 80s.
Well, there's a reason that they actually call Brian De Palma, and this is actually true, Brian De Plasma.
Because he has a big television.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure. Oh,
God. This month's movie segment.
Finish on a high note.
Has been recorded plunging off a bridge. No, has been recorded in JB's smokehouse in St. Helier, Jersey. Produced by Peterson Smogrocket. He is never working again, by the way. Like to say that if you liked it, leave us a review. Nobody does. We've been doing this for over a year. We have not a single review.
I mean, we ask every
on
week.
iTunes.
Every month, even.
Well, in fact, we have one, but I'm pretty sure that it was us. But we're both denying it.
Tex Riviera? Yeah. It has the feel of a producer name to me.
If you want to disagree with us about anything, then please tweet at WDAWKT.
Oh, yeah, I have nothing to do with the Twitter, so you can go for your life.
You can put it on Facebook, which I'm not on anymore, so that's fun.
Yeah, if you really want to piss me off, put it on Facebook. If you want to annoy a third party, put it on Twitter.
And if you want to get hold of us in real life, like on the actual phone, you can call us on 0121-555-3578. Next month... V?
Huh?
V.
V. We're just going to do V. Vagine, no.
And that's it. Until then.
We should also say thank you for nominating us for the podcast International Podcast Awards.
Oh, yeah, okay. So...
Thanks.
On behalf of... Mike, myself, and the rest of the cast and crew, thanks for making us do work for an award we're not going to win twice.
We will. I think we will.
No, we're blatantly going to win twice.
There's a reason they call me Danny Champion of the World. That's because I fucked Roald Dahl.
I thought you fucked a pheasant.
I fucked a gas tank.
Really?
You put sugar in a gas tank. It's the only thing I remember of that.
Okay.
Giving me the hurry up sign, and now you're keeping
beautiful.
This bit going.
That was, That wasn't the hurry up sign, that was the keep going sign.
Oh, okay. Well, it all began in 1974 when I first met the gas tank and the pheasant. Love blossomed very quickly. Soon we were three swimming.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this. Touch this. Can't touch this. My.
So that brings us to casting.
Okay.
Big casting news. The DA is played by one Mr. Lost my place in my notes. Let's start again. Yeah, I started with, I don't think I've got very much for this, I've accidentally written a book.
I'm using my radio voice now. This is my new voice for the podcast.
Oh God, the podcast is over. Okay. Yes, the Untouchables.
They're untouchable.
Can't touch this. Let's not ruin it. I'll start again.